Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. Well, that didn't take long. 11 weeks in, and we've started a new war, or I guess you should say a new front in a civil war. But we can't say we weren't warned. He told us.
I am the most militaristic, let's call it, of anybody that you've spoken to.
And we should have listened. The scary thing about our latest adventure in the Middle East is that I think the most charitable reading is that Trump spontaneously reacted to something he saw on TV that troubled him. The video of the victims of last week's chemical weapons attack in Syria. Again, that's the most charitable reading, that he went off half-cocked and ordered up some cruise missiles the way you and I might order up a pizza. It's interesting to see everyone take their usual positions on military action as though Donald Trump were a halfway competent president, right? The hawks and the liberal interventionists are at least cautiously optimistic. And I have to say, if I were a hawk, if I were a liberal interventionist, I wouldn't want this clown anywhere near my beloved interventions. Not everyone was pleased. Talking Point Memo reports, and I quote, some of President Donald Trump's most diehard supporters are turning against him over his sudden move Thursday night to launch missile strikes in Syria. Members of the white nationalist-friendly alt-right who boosted Trump's America First anti-interventionist campaign message found themselves at a loss. Apparently, there's a lot of tweets going around calling him a deep state neocon puppet. In that world, by the way, all U.S. wars are directed by Jews on the behalf of Israel. So they've decided, apparently, that Trump is now the first Jewish president, which is interesting, to say the least. Anyway, we'll discuss Syria in our second segment with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis is, among other things, the author of a new book titled ISIS and Syria, the New Global War on Terror. Before that, we'll be joined by Dave Roberts from Vox to talk about the conservative echo chamber in the age of Trump and how the rest of us have to adapt with the truthiest president we've ever had. First, a couple of items you may have missed. NBC reports that an NRA official, an employee at the organization, apparently shot himself at the organization's headquarters while doing firearms training. The 46-year-old man's pistol accidentally discharged Thursday afternoon as he holstered the gun in Fairfax County, Virginia, according to NBC's Washington Bureau. The Kentucky Coal Museum, which, by the way, must be loads of fun for the whole family, is switching over to solar power, according to CNN. A sign of the times, I guess. They're doing it to save money. According to a press flack, and I quote, it is a little ironic, but he went on to say that coal and solar and all the different energy sources work hand in hand. And of course, coal is still king around here. Meanwhile, Snowbilly grifter Sarah Palin released a book of so-called devotionals titled Sweet Freedom. I guess the bank account was getting a bit light. She's also posting them on her website. Her latest, titled Cry Me a River, begins thusly. So I wasn't overly sympathetic. Can you blame me? I was talking to a young lady who was devastated after a Facebook comment dissed her appearance. They didn't like your new do? I feigned understanding. How many Facebook followers you got there? 3, she said. Oh, dear Lord Jesus, spare me. Big hurts and little hurts, we've all got them. She went on to detail her own travails, being attacked by the media and mean liberals and whatnot. I don't know about you. When life has me down, I always turn to the homespun wisdom of a serial quitter, from Fox News. The Bureau of Land Management changed its website this week. Gone was the image of a majestic wild landscape. They replaced it with an image of, and I quote, an 80-foot coal seam at the North Antelope Rochelle open-cut coal mine, which is in Wyoming. Say what you want about the Trump administration. They are not subtle. They don't do nuance. I was personally disappointed at the news because I'd recommend they use a photo of an AK-47 and a bag of meth, but whatevs. Finally, a perfect story that captures both the depth and breadth of the Trump regime's ties to Russian officials and also their sheer ineptitude. BuzzFeed reported this week that Russian intelligence had tried and apparently failed to recruit former Trump advisor Carter Page to spy for Moscow. And an FBI wiretap revealed that Russian intelligence officials concluded that Page was dumb as a box of rocks. A transcript of two Russian spies, discussing the matter includes this quote. This is a transcript from an FBI surveillance. Page wrote that he is sorry he went to Moscow and forgot to check his inbox, but he wants to meet when he gets back. I think he is an idiot and forgot who I am. The old sorry, Boris, I forgot to check my inbox story. Just adding insult to injury, the FBI was quoted in this piece as saying, yeah, we're gonna investigate Page at some point when we get to it, but there are much more important people. And with that, let's move on with the show. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Dave Roberts. Stay tuned.
Why does my heart feel so bad? Why does my soul feel so bad? Why does my heart? Why does my heart
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Dave Roberts, usually my go-to guy on enviro issues, but Dave wrote a long think piece at Vox.com a few weeks back titled Donald Trump and the Rise of Tribal Epistemology. You can check it out at Vox.com. Dave Roberts, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey, Josh, good to be here.
You know, your piece fits into a broader theme we've been looking at since the election, and it is this. It is that Donald Trump is an authoritarian. He is clearly leading an authoritarian movement, but that doesn't mean we live in an authoritarian country. That requires our acquiescence. And when I say our acquiescence, I mean not only that of us, right, but more importantly, the institutions that support and maintain our pluralistic democracy. Anyway, your piece starts with a fairly familiar premise. We're deeply polarized. That polarization isn't strictly ideological. We've sorted ourselves into communities of like-minded people. We consume siloed media. We tend to talk to people with similar worldviews. And we've also become economically divided between, as you characterize it, and I quote, an economically booming urban country, albeit with plenty of poverty inside it, and a stagnant or declining rural and exurban one. What is it that strikes you as new about these dynamics in the age of Trump, or is it a matter of degree?
Yeah, that's, one of my main goals in writing the piece was to argue that this is not something new at all. That is, it is in fact the kind of the culmination of trends that have been going on for quite a while. I think this is true of Donald Trump in many areas, perhaps, but I think all he really did is kind of rip the veneer off of something that was already ugly. You know what I mean? I don't think he made it ugly. I think he just gave up on the euphemisms and the double talk and just made it very plain and obvious what was going on. So which is why it's now, you know, as I said in the piece, kind of unavoidable now for the media. I don't think there's any more room to hide or double talk it away.
Yeah, I think it was Rick Perlstein who said that Trump made subtext into text. You talk about asymmetric polarization, but there are fissures which aren't strictly ideological, which don't fit on a left-right continuum. You write in the piece, and again, I'm going to quote, on one side is what we might call the classic liberal democratic theory of politics. In this view, politics is a kind of structured contest. Factions and parties battle over interests and policies, but the field of play on which they battle is ring-fenced by a set of common institutions and norms. This is the nub of your argument, right? So there is in the conservative movement, and there has been for years, a faction, at least, that rejects that view. Unpack this for us, Dave.
Yeah, so I think the idea, and I feel like this that metaphor I laid out is sort of, I think it's widely shared, albeit mostly implicit in people's heads. So one of the things I wanted to do is just kind of make it explicit so we have a way of talking about it. But I think the idea, the classic sort of liberal democratic idea of how politics works is you have this sort of political contest that debates over policies and contested ideas, but that's bounded by this larger set of institutions and norms that serve as a kind of both a playing field on which these political battles play out, and also kind of referees for that contest. So the idea is, you know, you battle over contested issues, but you don't step outside that and violate norms. So, for instance, you don't explicitly try to deny certain target demographics the right to vote. You don't resort to violence. Right there, we have these sort of shared rules and these shared institutions to enforce them. And this is how democracy remains peaceful. Right, our political contests are constrained in a sense. They don't just spill over infinitely into contests of raw power. They're sort of contained by this set of institutions and norms. And I include in that sort of science, journalism, civil society. These are all the kind of referees that are like keep politics in bounds, I think. That's the sort of general idea. And so that's the worldview from which journalism gets its kind of self-conception in America, which is journalism is a neutral referee in this field of play, right? Journalists are neutral towards the substance of political battles, but they enforce, staying within the field of play. So if you stray by lying, or if you stray by saying something that science has determined is false, or you express a value that we've decided is out of bounds, journalism calls you on that, and then you are assessed some sort of penalty, which is maybe just reputational, maybe just you take a hit in the polls or whatever, and then you return to good behavior. That's the model, that's the idea, I think, that journalism is operating within, and that Democrats largely still see themselves as operating in. But as I said in the piece, the right has convinced itself, and this is precisely what's been going on for decades, this is definitely not new to Trump, the right has convinced itself that it's not just the other team in this political contest that's wrong and corrupt, but that the other team has taken over the institutions and the norms, and that the game itself now is run by the left, is run by one of the tribes. So that means, and now if that's true, then A, why pay any attention to the referees anymore, right?
Right.
They're claiming to have some sort of transpartisan authority that applies to everyone equally, but we know they're lying. We know they're really working for the left, right? So we don't have to listen to what they say anymore. So we don't have to listen to science anymore. We don't have to care what mainstream journalism says anymore. We don't really have to care about civil society anymore. We really only have to, can only trust and only owe any obligations to our tribe. It's a zero-sum contest, right? Tribe versus tribe. There's no such thing as overarching authorities to which they're both accountable, right? It's just us versus them. That's what's been going on for decades, and this is where I think you get the sorting, which puts every sort of these like-minded people in these rural exurban areas, sorts them all together, and then you have right-wing media, grassroots media, talk radio, and the rest of it has developed and has taken these people's natural tendency toward traditionalism and conservatism and just exacerbated it and hyped it up with fear and terror and anxiety.
Right.
And they've become completely insular now. They don't feel any fealty toward these common institutions. They think it's right v left, and that's the end of the story. And that's in epistemologically, that, you know, you end up with a closed off insular tribe of people who believe any old crazy thing that anyone on their side says and refuses to believe anything that the mainstream media says. So they become sort of structurally immune to correction or restraint or anything, and they've sort of just drifted off now. And this is the problem, I think, media, not just media, but all American institutions faces. We have a very large faction of the country, arguably, 30% to 40%, that's basically become its own completely separate tribe and no longer views itself as part of a shared project with the rest of us. So how do you solve that? It looks like the road from there is falling apart, right? So how do you prevent the falling apart? How do you not fall apart when you're stuck in this situation?
It seems like an intractable problem, and I just note that this is one of the, according to experts who testified in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee last week, we played some excerpts in last week's show, this lack of neutral arbiters facilitates the explosion of fake news and opens the door to manipulation from outside actors, as we saw in the 2016 election. As you know, Dave, they didn't try to make those institutions more receptive to their worldview. They built their own alternatives to it. So Fox News, all those scad of other dedicated conservative outlets, you have like Liberty University and a constellation of conservative think tanks that produce a lot of like reams of dubious scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that they've reached a point where this is hurting their movement? Right now we look at Trump, his approval ratings are pathetic, really the worst since they started tracking these things. And a fair degree of that is that the media, although it still has clung to the convention of, you know, Democrats say this, Republicans say that,
right,
they are constantly calling out his falsehoods. And I wonder if this echo chamber has become so insular that it's given reporters leave to be critical in a way that they weren't with more mainstream regimes.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have two answers for that. One is, and I was just saying this to somebody the other night. You know, there's this kind of wave of autocracy, of populist autocracy, sweeping the globe right now. You know, there's Russia and Poland and Hungary, Philippines, Turkey. We see all these sort of democracies sliding into populist autocracy. And so in a sense, I feel like it was a little bit inevitable that that wave would hit our shores. I think when we look back, this might be too early to say anything even remotely optimistic, but I'll risk it. I think when we look back on this period of our history, we will view it as an incredible, incredible, fateful stroke of luck that when our turn came, we got a dumbass. So we didn't get.
That's very well said, Dave.
We didn't get a Putin or an Erdogan or anybody like that.
Right.
We got, I mean, the institutions, American institutions, are so, rotten in so many ways, and so kind of desiccated and tired in so many ways, that I feel like it just would have been so easy for Donald Trump to co-opt the media and to co-opt some centrist Democrats, and to co-opt, there's institutions everywhere that were ripe for co-option, right? But instead, he's a dumbass, and he came in and just is deliberately and openly antagonizing all these institutions in such a way that he's actually reviving them a little bit. Like, he's having the opposite effect. He's actually causing them to have, you know, look at what happened to civil society when he came in. And like you say, media is actually like, looks like it's getting a little bit of a spine, a little bit of an identity, a little bit of its vim back, you know? So I think it doesn't feel like we're lucky at the moment.
Right.
But I think history will look back and will say, if we had to deal with an autocrat, we're super lucky that we got this one, right? Because he's just f***ing it up. He's messing up autocracy. He's blowing it. So that's the first answer. The second answer, though, on the broader question of whether this insularity is hurting them, I think obviously, yes. I mean, I think you saw that a little bit. It was all a little bit less developed back then, but you go back and look at the George W. Bush regime. You know, already that insularity had started. And already, and during the Bush regime, you saw the wages of that. You saw when they only talk to one another and they only read intelligence that each other has already sort of massaged to a predetermined conclusion, and you only hear certain voices that tell you, yeah, the country wants you to privatize Social Security, that'll be awesome. You know, like when you only hear your own voice echoed back at you, you just don't know what's going on in the world. So you are going to, so it makes for very, here's how I would put it. The insularity makes for extremely good opposition, right? Due to the quirks in America's system, it's quite effective just to sit on the sidelines and shout insane lies and conspiracy theories. Like, that turned out to be a very good way of blunting Democrats' effectiveness when they're in office. But what you're seeing now is actually running a government is a complicated thing that requires some,
yes,
intelligence and some planning. Like, you can't just be a Fox pundit. I sort of feel like on the left, and maybe you've detected the same thing, I've always felt like a lot of people look at the right, the sort of clownish face of the far right, and assume on some level, this is just the public face, right? Somewhere in the back rooms, they've got some smart operators pulling the strings and determining strategy, and this is all for show, and this is all deliberate, right? I mean, this is why people clung to the Karl Rove myth, right? Because there's this sense that, like, surely it can't be clownish all the way down, right? Surely it can't be clownish all the way through. Surely there's not clowns beneath the clowns. But I think, again, what you're seeing now, Trump is ripping off the veneer and showing, yes, the entire structure of that party, of that movement, is intellectually exhausted and hollow. No one knows what the f*** is going on. All they have is pundit-level sound bites, and witness their utter inability to get anything done, right? So yes, I mean, insularity is great for opposition, but it is hell for a ruling party. I mean, one of the greatest things about Obama was his intense dedication to hearing out different theories and different ideas and weighing them. You know what I mean? Like, this was part of his no drama shtick, which we're all, I think, probably missing more and more.
Yes, we are. And I laughed, but I mean, it's a very serious point that you make. You can imagine a smoother demagogue, one with less rough edges, one who doesn't tweet nonsense all the time, one who focuses, who has an attention span, who has some managerial experience, and who understands how coalition politics works. That's really key. You could imagine somebody like that really consolidating power, marginalizing the opposition, marginalizing these institutions we've been talking about, the media and others.
Yeah, we've seen it happen over and over again.
Yes, we have.
We've seen it.
I mean, look, Vladimir Putin has overwhelmingly high popularity in Russia. Of course, some of that is due to Russia-specific cultural realities.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the reality is that he is a far smoother operator than Donald Trump. Now, you shy away from offering a prescription for this problem. I don't blame you for that, by the way. You write that the mainstream press has to kind of figure out a balance between being fair and consistent, being referees, the idea that
right.
it is neutral, and defending the institutional integrity of these institutions, including itself. Do they have to abandon the norm toward neutrality, or in part abandon the norm toward neutrality to do that?
Well, I think, I mean, part of my goal was is to separate two kinds of neutrality, right? And they're like you just said, one is neutrality between political parties on matters of contested substance, right? So, like, how, you know, should Social Security means test, or, you know, stuff like that, stuff that is the subject of political dispute. I feel like neutrality from the mainstream press on those matters is good and fine. But then there's these, are America's core institutions and norms worth defending or not? On that, I don't think journalism can be neutral, because if it's neutral, if those institutions and norms go, journalism goes with it, right? So at a certain point, just to defend the possibility of its own existence, journalism has to take a side on that. So, but the difficulty of this, and the reason I sort of shied away from a solution, because it very well may be unsolvable, is that the line between what's a legitimately contested political issue and what's kind of an inviolate shared norm or law is fuzzy, right? It's fuzzy. Like, we used to think it was a legitimate subject of political debate, you know, whether slavery was okay or not, right?
Right.
We don't think of that as political anymore. We sort of moved that out of politics into this realm of kind of fixed, shared norms and laws. But there are lots of other issues that are on that contested line, right? Like we kind of thought, I think before Trump, we kind of thought, at least probably us white liberals, kind of thought, well, I think like there's plenty of structural racism left in the world and racial issues remain obviously a huge deal for America, but at least we've taken explicit racism off the table, right? That's no longer acceptable. At least we've managed to push that out of the circle of legitimate political topics. But, you know, apparently not.
Yeah.
Apparently we were premature in thinking that. But you know what I mean? So, like, it's...
I do.
So it's tricky. It's tricky for journalism, right? Because you want to defend the institutions and norms that make America work, that are core to it, but you also don't want to put your thumb on the scales of these sort of political contested issues. And it's and especially in sort of uncertain times like these, it can be really difficult to tell where that line is. You know, and you can get that line wrong in the other way too. Like this is, I know you've railed about this before, but for a long time, American journalists took the notion that that America is in debt and that the deficit is a bad thing and that we need to reduce the deficit as outside the realm of politics, right? As this sort of like core thing that everybody knows, this core value that we all share, you know, and sort of liberals have been trying for years now to drag it back into the
contested territory,
the realm of contest, right? Yeah. And say, no, that's not, we can't just assume that, it's stupid. You know what I mean? So this is the this is why it's a problem for the media, is because Donald Trump wants to drag all sorts of things into the political arena that we had thought were out of bounds, right? Like, is it okay for the president to run the country with his family by his side, remaining connected to his businesses, using his office to accomplish business deals? Like, we had all thought, I think, that that was commonly agreed to be out of bounds, right? And he dragged it back in. Now it's
yes.
a controversy. Now we're like arguing whether that's a thing or not, you know? And he's dragging all sorts of stuff back in. So I sort of feel like it can't always be somebody else's job to fight for that stuff. You know what I mean? Like, whose civil society is out there kind of fighting for it? But I feel like America's institutions at a certain point have to wake up and defend themselves. You know, even though it's difficult and even though it's complicated, like if you look at the Science March, I don't know if you've covered this much, the big march for science that's coming up on Earth Day, you see a lot of the same tricky issues, namely what is strictly part of science and the scientific method and what's a contested value, right? So we're marching for science. Are we also marching for diversity in science?
Right.
Or is that science taking sides in something that science should be neutral on, right? There's a huge debate going on about that. And so it's difficult, and there's all these difficult questions you have to answer, but I feel like it's just, you just can't avoid it anymore. We can't all just stand by and be spectators as Trump drags our institutions and norms down the toilet.
Yes, I agree. And there's a much more banal challenge for the media, which is that you have this guy who can make a story out of nothing. He can literally pull something
yeah.
from his rectum. The idea that, you know, the Obama White House spied on him. Now all of a sudden you see this rush of journalism. All these journalists have to chase that down and treat it like it's a story, because it is a story when the president says something like
mm-hmm.
that. Like, objectively speaking, that's news. And yet they are spending, you know, finite time, finite resources, chasing that nonsense down when they could be reporting on matters of substance. So there's an opportunity cost here that is that's another
totally.
Real challenge for reporters, I think.
This is one of the things autocrats get, I think, instinctively, is how to take the kind of tropes and habits of journalism, many of which developed for good reason, right,
yes.
which have good justification, and exploit them to their own effect. But again, Trump is too dumb and narcissistic to do that on any kind of systemic or adept level. He's so transparently needy, you know, that he just can't get the separation he needs to exploit the media properly. You know, there's an interesting video on Vox right now. Not to self-promote, but there's an interesting video on Vox right now about the role comedians, like late night comedians, have been playing in the Trump years. And part of what it's saying is that in a lot of ways, late night comedians are responding better and more effectively to Trump than the news people are, because they're not trapped by these conventions, so they can't be led around by the nose. So, like, if Trump says Obama tapped my phones, a neutral journalist has to say, well, the president says this, the evidence says this, blah, 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 and write some serious-sounding news story about it, which makes the whole thing sound serious.
Right.
Right? Whereas a late-night comedian can say, that is a load of bullshit. That is obvious bullshit, right? Which is the correct way to respond to that, right? Is just to mock it. But journalism doesn't have that. It doesn't have that tool, right? It doesn't have that option. So in a sense, like you know, like the Samantha Bees of the world and John Olivers are kind of freer to be honest in their reactions to Trump than journalists are.
I think that's a really good point. I saw Ezra Klein promote that piece earlier on. I didn't actually get a chance to check it out. Dave Roberts, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us this week. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Folks, check out Dave's piece at Vox.com. It's titled Donald Trump and the Rise of Tribal Epistemology. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
Scott, if I ever see you, I am going to kill you. And then I get sent back to jail, the Pope will send the bail in tens and twenties, cause his God is funny, spent all my money and I still feel lost, cause people like the same things that you do, people like the same things that you do. Scott, why'd you have to do it? Why couldn't you see through it? Like us, you tore through her bolted soul. You made it past the toll, but I paid the cost. Cause people like the same things that you do. People like the same.
Back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Phyllis Banas. Phyllis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us today on such short notice.
Good to be with you.
Listeners should know we're recording this on Friday afternoon. This is a still developing story, and you may know more than we do when you listen to the broadcast. That's especially true for folks in Wisconsin, where the show airs on Monday evening. 13 hours ago, the U.S. launched 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase, ostensibly to retaliate for the Assad regime's alleged use of chemical weapons on civilians. I should note that we have been bombing targets in Syria for several years, and what's new here is that we targeted regime forces. In the past, we have targeted ISIS and al-Nusra and other so-called jihadi groups. Phyllis, you're a foreign policy expert. I'm not even certain that this action should really be analyzed in those terms. For the last 2 years, Trump has demonized Syrians and also said over and over again that we can't be the world's cop. we should let them fight it out. I don't want to be president of the world, etc. So either he suddenly underwent some kind of deep and fundamental change in temperament and developed the capacity for empathy, or he looked weak, the Russia story wouldn't go away, his polls were plummeting, and he fired off a bunch of cruise missiles in the hopes of changing the media narrative and looking tougher than his predecessor. He showed that he's willing to buck the Russians, and I ask myself, which of those is more likely? To me, the answer is fairly clear. Your view, am I being too cynical?
I don't think you're being too cynical. I think there's a few other cynical possibilities as well. I don't think we really know yet. I think there is a pretty good chance that, for reasons completely unknown and without any shred of logic, this particular set of horrifying video of children dying in a horrific war in which children have been dying horrific deaths for years now, caused by the regime, caused by Russian bombing, caused by U.S. bombing, caused by attacks by the allies of the United States, caused by everybody. It's been a horrifying war where Syrian people, ordinary people, children, women, men, have gotten nothing from this war except death and destruction. So that's the context in which this happens. For whatever reason, and I don't think it's because there are particular laws, international laws, prohibiting chemical weapons that do not necessarily apply to other kind of weapons, I don't think that's why this particular set of videos caught the attention of Trump. Now, why he responded the way he did, I don't know, but it was pretty clear in his voice that there was something going on. For whatever reason, he was reacting to this. And as we know, this is a president who reacts quickly, without thought, spontaneously, without any discipline, to anything he sees on television. He saw these videos on television, and he said, I've got to do something. And you could tell there was some kind of emotional connection, God knows why, when there hasn't been, when he's been perfectly willing to participate in and be the commander of the attacks in Mosul that left hundreds of people dead, many of them children, that has said that Syrian children, desperate to come to the United States because it's the only place they can find safety, should have the door slammed in their face. He's been completely prepared to say all of that. Somehow this was different. On the other hand, his response was not to say, oh my God, we've been wrong. We've been following a trajectory that is guaranteed to hurt the children of Syria, and I now understand that these beautiful children have the right to live. I'm going to end my exclusion of Syrian refugees. I'm going to start refunding USAID to make sure that all of the refugees and internally displaced people get all the support they need. We're going to join the International Criminal Court so we can be sure everybody who might be guilty of such heinous crimes is held accountable. He could have done a whole bunch of things. But being that this is Donald Trump and being that this is the United States and Mad Dog Mattis and everybody else around him, what he said was, we have to do something. That means military. Let's send the bomber. What happens now? There's no answer. No one in Congress is yet demanding answers on that. This was a military strike carried out in complete violation of both domestic law, which requires, number one, that Congress be consulted, that Congress give its authorization, et cetera. There's a division of power between the centers of power in Washington. That was completely ignored. This was done just on his own.
Yes.
The gang of eight in Congress, the leaders of the two parties in the four main committees in each House, were briefed afterwards, just told what happened, basically. But briefing afterwards is no equivalence to actual consultation and, crucially, getting actual authorization. It was also a complete violation of international law, which, as you know, Joshua, prohibits any use of military force except under two very narrowly defined circumstances. One, if the Security Council decides and approves it. That didn't happen. The U.S. didn't even try to get that. Or number two, Article 51 of the U.N. Charter that talks about self-defense. And self-defense is defined very, 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 very narrowly. It says that if a country has been attacked, which we were not, then immediate military force can be used to stop that attack only until, so it's another condition, only until the Security Council can meet and decide what to do. If the Security Council decides not to authorize military force, that's the end of it.
Right.
Any military force after that moment is a direct violation of the UN Charter and an act of war, an act of aggression.
Now, here I think that we really need to understand that what you're talking about strikes me as an irreconcilable paradox. Trump says he's trying to uphold an important international norm, a convention, in fact, barring the use of chemical weapons. But as you say, there's another important convention against waging war unilaterally, other than in self-defense or when approved by the UN Security Council. So he's trying to uphold an international norm by violating an international norm.
The yes is he mentioned the violation of the international norm, which is the prohibition against the use of chemical weapons. He was assuming, we don't yet have evidence, it's likely, but not by any means proven, that this was carried out by the regime. But whoever carried it out, it was clearly a violation. But he mentioned that there had been a violation, but he said that this attack was carried out to defend U.S. national interests. Now, what is the U.S. national interest here? He talked about non-proliferation. Non-proliferation is fine, but whatever you think about it and how it's applied, whether it's applied in a even-handed way or in a discriminatory way or whatever, no non-proliferation rules allow military force to be used to enforce them.
Well, this is my fundamental point.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this: which of those two norms would you say has decreased bloodshed more effectively, even though they're not consistently honored?
Well, both and neither. Neither are consistently honored, as you say. They are more frequently honored in the breach than
yes.
in the abiding by them. But I would say overall, there's no question that the UN Charter trumps, to put a too fine a point on it, the UN Charter is more important than any particular international norm like either non-proliferation or the specific prohibition on the use of chemical weapons.
That's my take exactly. And let me just
add, no question that that's the more important one.
And let me just add one other thing. Chemical weapons are ineffective as battlefield weapons against other professional armies. They are weapons of terror against civilian populations. But you know what? You don't need chemical weapons to terrorize civilian populations. You can do it with conventional weapons, and that's how it's usually done.
That's true. I would also note, though, that there is a particular terror that comes with chemical weapons use. No one is sure what it is, how did this happen, where is it coming from, what do we do? There is a particular kind of terror, and that may be why it was employed. There was a useful article in the Friday morning New York Times where Ann Barnard, who tends to be, I think, a very good reporter, put forward an analysis of what might be the thinking of people in and around the regime towards carrying this out. It was a bit counterintuitive, and it was importantly so, because I kept thinking, reading it, you know, a lot of us, myself included, and others have been saying, this doesn't make sense in terms of rationale for the regime. They were winning on the battlefield, as whatever we think about this horrific regime, and you can tell what I think about it.
Yes.
But it was winning on the battlefield. It was facing, on the same day, an international conference going on in Brussels that was going to determine how much European money would be available for Syria after the war, and would that depend on whether or not Bashar al-Assad remained the president of Syria? Why would you do something like this, guaranteed to get a lot of negative attention, to put it mildly, at the moment that that's going forward? It doesn't make any sense. But what she noted, and it was very similar to what I think was part of the thinking of Saddam Hussein with the weapons of mass destruction, where people kept saying, well, if he doesn't have them, why doesn't he just say that? Why doesn't he just say he doesn't have them and let us go look?
Right.
Well, the reason was it wasn't about whether he had them or not. It was about his need at that time to convince his enemies that he might.
That he was stronger than he was.
And that gave him strength.
Yes.
That he was stronger than he actually was.
Let me just,
in this case, this has something to do with making life unlivable, untenable for the families and the fighters of the Syrian opposition. That's who was the target here. These weren't just any old Syrian civilians. these were people, this part of Idlib had been an area that families and fighters had been transferred to during a number of these surrender operations that the Syrian regime had imposed. So that's who he was targeting here, and there was a message in it. Your life is going to be hell, partly as punishment, partly to drive people out, to consolidate his rule. It wasn't pointless from his ruthless military vantage point.
Right, right. That piece, by the way, an excellent read. It's called The Grim Logic Behind Syria's Chemical Weapons Attack. It's in the New York Times by Anne Bernard. Good piece. Phyllis, this is a messy, sprawling conflict. It's a regional proxy war. It's now a superpower proxy something, not war necessarily as well.
Right.
How many combatant groups are currently operating in Syria? Do you know off the top of your head?
Oh, there are hundreds, probably still over 1,000. But I think the more relevant question is, how many wars? By my last count, when I wrote my book on ISIS and the global war on terror, I documented 7 separate wars that were being waged in Syria. That was at the end of 2015. I think now it's up over 11. There are regional wars. There's a war for regional hegemony between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's being waged in Syria. There's a war between Turkey and the Kurds being waged in Syria. There's a global war between the U.S. and Russia, which changes and morphs into different things, but is still there, being waged in Syria. All of these wars are being waged to the last Syrian, and only one of them has anything to do with Syria, the war between the Syrian regime and a large part of its population, the civil war, the original civil war. All of these other wars, proxy wars, are being fought by outside actors where Syrians are involved only in that they are doing the dying. And that's the incredible tragedy of this.
Now, here's where I was going with that. There is something, I think, approaching a consensus in this country among the general public and the media that we can kind of fix any problem if we can only get the policy right. And I don't think that's true. I think we could certainly do a lot to ameliorate, I'm sorry, that's a tough word, I always stumble over it, the refugee crisis, which is both a humanitarian nightmare and also putting this massive strain on Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey. But there's a question that I grapple with. You have all these different combatants, and there's a concept in conflict resolution, in the conflict resolution literature, called ripeness. And the idea is that a conflict isn't going to end in a negotiated political settlement until all of the different combatants are exhausted and calculate that fighting is no longer a viable path to achieving their end goals. Is the conflict in Syria ripe for resolution, or is it unlikely to be solved through international conflict resolution at this stage and given
yes,
the myriad actors?
It is ripe, but it is unlikely to work because of the way they're approaching it. I think that it's been ripe from the beginning. I don't necessarily ascribe to that notion of conflict resolution. I think that sometimes these writers take a bit too much off the third grade playground and try to impose it on the world. That's true at times. At other times, I think it's not. One of the things that's happening here is that these various wars in Syria that are being fought by other actors also involve the constant shipping of massive amounts of armaments into Syria to support the various sides. And so whatever conflict resolution mechanism you bring about, if you bring about a ceasefire here or there, or even a national ceasefire, as long as you're continuing to flood the place with new arms, there is not going to be a ceasefire that holds. So when I outlined, for example, in my book, the steps that have to happen, the things that have to happen, one of the most important and probably the single most difficult one is to move towards understanding gradually, slowly, et cetera, to move towards a full and complete arms embargo on all sides. Now, that's an almost impossible thing to imagine, but we have to start talking about it to understand its necessity. Because right now, for example, you see the U.S. all the time talking about how outrageous it is that Russia and Iran are arming the Syrian regime. And they're right. It's a terrible regime. Nobody should be arming it. They shouldn't be flooding it with arms. But why would anyone think the U.S. government has any credibility to have any influence on Russia and Iran, when the U.S. is flooding the place with arms for anyone and its brother who says they're supporting ISIS or says, that they're fighting ISIS or says that they're fighting against the regime. So you need an absolute embargo, which has to start with one side doing it unilaterally. I vote for the U.S. because I live in this country. It's my tax money. Now, that's not going to be easy. You know, the ones who are making a killing from this war, aside from the people who are doing the dying, the ones who are making the killing are Raytheon and General Dynamics and McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and all these massive companies whose CEOs are making out like bandits.
If you had oil futures, you'd probably do okay.
Yeah, maybe.
Let me ask you this. Russia condemned the attack as an act of aggression. Do you sense that they're going to be satisfied with a statement of condemnation, or do you expect them to take any concrete action to make our lives more difficult beyond what they've said they'll do already, which is to send Syria more defense systems?
I think it's unlikely that Russia is going to take a next step that's military or quasi-military, not least because, ironically enough, Putin's government has proved itself to be somewhat more the grown-up in the room relative to the United States these days. So I don't think that's as likely. The problem is we don't know whether the Trump administration is finished. They have said this was not a one-off event, but I'm guessing that they're actually waiting to see what the responses are before they decide whether or not to go again. I don't think that the Russians are prepared to sit through significant further efforts to undermine and destroy the military capacity of Russia's one ally remaining in the Arab world, which is Syria, an alliance that they are very protective of. The irony is, of course, earlier in the wars, I think there's little question that Russia would have been perfectly willing to sell out Assad in a minute if whatever government followed him was prepared to commit to maintaining the relationship with Russia, allowing Russia to maintain its naval base at Tartus, continuing to buy Russian weapons, etc. Russia is concerned with Russian interests. I don't think they care at all about keeping this particular Syrian dictator in power. The problem is once they intervene directly, then everything is shaken up. Then it's a whole new equation. Then it becomes much harder to imagine that they would allow their personal connection in the country to be undermined. So it means that the role that Russia plays is a much more immediate one relative to the actual defense of Assad's government.
Folks, it's once we've started down this road, you know, the real danger is that is mission creep, basically. We shot off some cruise missiles. It's certainly not going to change anything in Syria except to create some more rubble and some more bodies. But we need to really watch what happens next. Phyllis Bennis, I can't thank you enough for taking the time again on short notice. I only asked you to do this interview an hour before you did. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua. It's been a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank Dave Roberts. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or anywhere else you can find it. I'd also like to thank Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. Of course, I would like to thank you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.